The Dry Arch Complex 24-hour service station, Letterkenny. We're here for all your needs.
It's 7 p.m. It's Monday evening. It's time for the DL debate.
Check this.
Right, folks, thanks for joining us on the DL debate. Hope you're staying safe out there. And we are here at Highland following protocol. No studio guests, just people on the line. But we've got some great guests this evening. And one of them is a Kerry man that's found his way up to Donegal. However that happened, maybe you could let us know. Mick Clifford, how are you, sir?
Not bad at all, Brendan. How are you keeping?
The very best, Mick. Glad to be talking to you, Mick. You're obviously an award-winning columnist, Mick, and I love your articles in the Mail and the Mail on Sunday. Usually the Mail on Sunday, Mick, when I have a bit more time to relax and read your in-depth analysis, Mick. I just wondering, you're living up in Donegal. How did that come about?
Well, Brendan, I'd like to say that I got a grant from the Healy Rays to come up with a good woman. A good woman from your neck of the country that brought me up.
No better women.
Donegal woman.
You know, my mum's from Galway, Mick, and it's that trip then, you know, if you hook up with a woman from a long distance, there's that haul up and down the road. Now, the road has improved, but I'd say for years there, it was a bit of a haul going back to see the folks.
Oh, God, yeah. That's about 2 hours after coming off the road in the 10 years that I've been up here. But, as a man says, when you don't have the kids in the car, you shoot up and down there, no bother.
It's a big commitment. Mick, I was just wondering, you know, where you see the current situation around club and county and that, do you see there being now a condensed championship and big changes in it? I know everything's very much up in the air, everything gets cleared out, but there won't be time for, I suppose, things to continue as normal from a GAA perspective.
I'd say not, Brendan. I mean, look, it's inevitably, it's going to be very condensed. I would say the best case scenario, and at this stage, probably the best case scenario, and nobody knows, but I would suspect is if you take the League of Ireland and the FAI, what they set a date for the resumption of their league for the 19th of June. Now that's a shot in the dark, but I would imagine that's probably around the roughly the same period of time that GAA is probably right now looking at in the best case scenario. And that would be probably a condensed championship, old-style knockout provincial championship with All-Ireland semi-finals and an All-Ireland final. And I suppose the kick-on is, say, if it started in the end of July, into June, the kick-on effect on the clubs would be, I mean, look, here in Donegal, the championship is played on the round-robin, the initial stages. It may well be that the club championships will adopt a similar style, just like Tyrone had, you know, straight knockout championships. Nobody knows, but all of that is a best case scenario, because there's no guarantee. Because I mean, I was just listening to Michael O'Neill, the Mayo man that's involved with the World Health Organization. He was making the point, you know, and he's made it more than once, that people think that, but you know, when the social restrictions stop and all these things relax, that you know, this virus comes back, that's almost an inevitability. If that being the case, I think whatever you'll see happening, it'll be a phased lifting of restrictions, and any sign of a pandemic returning, at you know, bearing its teeth again, you'll see the curtain, you'll see the shutters come back down. So, you know, you can't rule out the worst case scenario that there simply won't be a championship this year.
Yeah, and I guess, Mick, it's funny sometimes when we discuss sport and the ramifications of what can happen. As you saying, we have this image in our mind that, you know, everybody tightens up now and we can beat this virus. But as you're saying, a second wave of it, and suddenly the thought of sport in general, I suppose, goes out the window, you know, because at that stage the fear comes about, it doesn't really matter. And I was just wondering, Mick, you know, around clubs and the bedrock of the community, you know, we see clubs helping out, you know, delivering food, etc. I just wonder, Mick, financially now, there's clubs obviously have loans out facilitating them, and that it's in a bit of a scary time, because they're relying on obviously gates coming in from league and from sponsors and different situations. What do you think is going to be the outcome of those for the clubs in particular?
There is, I mean, that is an issue, and you see the particularly, you know, regarding things like, you know, the club lottery. If you're in Donegal, and I would socialise a lot out around Lahey and Nave Breed. They have their club lottery, you know, and you know that's the financial lifeblood of all clubs. You know, it's I'm sure for Masters the same. All the clubs around here are the same. I suppose, look, it's like every commercial business. I'm assuming that anyone with financial loans are at this stage are going to have financial institutions that are going to take a very forgiving view on that. I suppose the other side of this, and it probably feeds into the county as well, Brendan, is that you will have less expenses when you're not in action. The whole area of players' expenses and the various travel costs and all the other things, all those right now are curtailed, and certainly that's going to happen at inter-county level, where just the irony is that prior to this, the big talking point, I suppose, at the start of this year was the amount of, with all the talk about where is the ceiling on inter-county costs. Well, I mean, they're going to find that there is a ceiling on inter-county costs when there is no activity, and that might just in terms of looking to the future, that might dictate the way, when we get over this crisis, and whenever we get over this crisis, that they may well, the GA may well look at it and say, well, maybe a county's championship with less inter-county fixtures over a shorter period of time would release an awful lot of the financial pressures on county boards and provide a larger window for club activity. That is one possibility.
Listen, Mick, I think that's definitely a way forward. The problem is getting people to agree to that, and with the strength of county managers and the way that the imbalance has come around, because the driver and the money and the TV is all about the county, it's completely taken over in terms of who calls the shots. And until we realise, where the heart lies, which is with club football, and sure, the cream of the crop is the county, and that is, I find the championship brilliant, fascinating, the same as you, Mick, and there's so many people that enjoy it, but we got to remember, we're not the Premier League. It's not all about the top teams. It's about everybody being involved. And I think that's a huge side of it, Mick. You're right. This could be, a time to, I suppose, get back to basics in terms of who we are and what we're about. And that the problem is, the same, Mick, is just getting people to commit to that, because every competition has been hyped. You take your early season competitions, McKenna Cups and that, the media getting behind them, I suppose that's their job, and they see them in the National League and then into the Championship, and now the Super 8s, and you think, right, where is the time for club?
Absolutely. The other thing about it, Brendan, if you look at it, and you mentioned right there at the start, this is bringing out the very best in the GA. We are seeing the GA as a community-led organisation. Well, look, I suppose it's a bit like, hopefully, it's a bit like, as a society, that we'll emerge from this. And in the same way that there'll be a newfound appreciation maybe for our frontline services, particularly for our doctors and our nurses that are putting their lives literally on the line over the coming week, that the same thing trickles down to even something like the GA, where they say, what's really been a practical help and what has been a huge support to communities are the local club units. And the GA is getting an awful lot of what you might call good PR, the kind of PR they could never hope for, because, apart from giving up their grounds and all the rest, but it's that huge volunteer effort. But we see that every week of the year. Every time there's a funeral or a tragedy or something happens in the community, the GA inevitably fronts up at local level. So it's very important that the GA then at the top looks down and says, well, look, this is what our club units are doing in times of great crisis among their community. Should we afford them the respect and the space in terms of a sporting organisation to give them the window to play their games and give them a reasonable amount of time and give those players a set fixture calendar? I think they have to do that, and it will be a case really of, yeah, it will cost the GA money, but the GA was never supposed to be a financial institution. It was never supposed to be about money and annual turnover and all that. It was supposed to be about participation. And the vast amount of participation is at grassroots level. 98% to 99% of its memberships are in the grassroots, and maybe that's where, a bit like how we've got to, as well, be a more caring society after this, the GA should care more about its grassroots after this.
Yeah, 100%. Mick, and just thinking there about what you're saying, the amount of times I've seen GA clubs go out of their way to help people in times of need, and what they do in the community. Yet there is, and I notice it here, a few things have come up. There's like an anti-GA brigade, and I think it's people not looking. They're probably looking at all the money in Crow Park, and a lot of the stuff gets fired out there. And I just think sometimes I see some stuff going up, particularly in social media, a real kind of anti thing. And I think, do you realise all the stuff that goes on in the GAA, the good stuff, you know. And funny, Paul Flynn's going to come on this show in a few weeks' time. I don't know where that went in terms of their negotiation, but I was saying that to him as well with the GAA. You know, the GPA now is looked as the bad guy in the room. And I said, they do a lot of good work for people and help who their players are, but that's their job. But we don't hear them stories. And I was just, what do you think of them, Mick? Because it looks like...
Paul Flynn has obviously got to defend his corner. I would argue that there's too much of an emphasis on the inter-county. And I'd be far more concerned if I was the GAA how a club players association came in to being rather than the Gaelic Players Association, because the Gaelic Players Association came in to be on the model, I suppose, really of looking after elite players. And I understand that. I think the GAA were very, very negligent. If you go back, Brendan, I said, to your own time when you were playing, you go back to it, you know, there was players weren't getting a fair shout, they weren't getting proper expenses, they certainly weren't being compensated for the time they lost, and I think all that was absolutely necessary, and the GPA have done a good job on that, and they've put in a lot of programs, and they're well funded for that. But the problem with that is that all that funding is focused on the inter-county model generating as high a turnover as possible. Now, I would always argue the GPA, if we're dealing with player welfare issues at that level, surely we should be going to what's causing the problem. If the issue is that it's taking up too much of players' time, should we not be having a more condensed season and less time demanded of players, rather than providing money for welfare programs for employment and for mental health issues and all the other byproducts that are added? You know, we cared about gambling addictions and all the rest. And if all of these are in some way linked to the inter-county lives that these players are living, surely the answer is not to throw money at it, but to ensure that they live a more balanced life. Less games and less time. You know, we've had an ESRI report which suggested that the average inter-county player is committing 33 hours a week to their hobby. So, I mean, that's effectively another full-time sport.
Yeah.
So I think that should be the focus of the GPA rather than on its funding mechanisms.
Yeah, and I think there's in my mind, Mick, there's a whole issue around this around Dublin and the how different everything is up there in Crow Park in particular, and everything goes on, you know, very different. You think about the Dublin Gaelic team compared to, you know, the three, and particularly Division 3, 4 and probably 2 as well. You know, what's happening around them, you know, all that's a huge imbalance as well. And I think you're right, probably this is a time to get back to basics, because I think a lot of people forget that the GPA players are CPA players as well.
Yeah.
And I think that putting them into one box or another, you know, we have brilliant games, you know, huge support, people have such joy out of them, Mick, and now these issues are popping up, I've been let fester because we've opened the door up wrong. You know, how things was funded and the way money was channeled has all gone now in the wrong direction. And while they say the GPA of a certain percentage now guaranteed, they're obviously going to look to have that upped. And
absolutely,
that's going to be their starting point, which I think is throwing light and everybody's saying, right, why are they getting this money and what needs to be done? But listen, Mick, brilliant points there. Thanks very much for joining us, Mick. And I hope to see you soon, maybe in the midsummer. We'll be back. Championship, and it'll be back to knockout. It'll be exciting stuff, and hopefully we beat this, and that's the way it'll end up, Mick.
I'm sure we will. I hope to God we do, Brendan.
All the best, sir.
Cheers.
Thank you so much.
The Dry Arch Complex 24-hour service station, Letterkenny. We're here for all your needs.
Right, folks, now I'm joined on the line by current hurling manager Mickey McCann, former Burt and Donegal player himself. How are you, Mickey?
Good, Brendan. Yourself?
Tearing away, sir. Am I pulling you away from your work there? You were flat out doing a bit of building, were you?
We keep going. Why we get the chance now? You don't know when it's going to come in, and you know, so we'll keep at it.
Take a quick break there. Mickey, listen, I was just bailing you up there. I know you were a fine hurler yourself, corner forward, half forward. Good footballer as well. You know, people mightn't just know that around the Burt football team as well. Mickey, you came under Burt. There was a kind of clutch of good young players at the time, yourself and likes of McCann and China, Ardo, you know, Barry Freeland, that you were all top hurlers. And Burt at that time was Donegal, and it was a massive success. You know, and it's amazing to see, because we always talk about hurling being, you know, such a definitive game about being born with a stick in that. But this one wee area, Donegal, was able to do what it did. Like, it must have been an amazing time.
Well, Brendan, I suppose they represent the whole county team from one club, you know, and to compete well against the likes of Armagh and teams that that are competing hard against us at the minute. Look, we had a strong bunch of players, very competitive, Bren, and playing both codes. And Pose were in good shape playing both codes. And look, we're very competitive, knew one all very well on the pitch. And look, it paid off for us, Bren. I suppose you were out 3 or 4 times a night, week with a stick, you know. And the hurling was around this, and just representing 14 Bartman was a great time for us, you know, and nearly got an All-Ireland title out of it, only to lose out to a good Roscommon team, you know.
That's right, that's right. And tell me, the Bart team at that time, was the season very long then for you all, Mickey? Because you only certain players normally represent the county, and it goes through phases, but you'd 1A in Bart, you'd 1A obviously in Donegal. Was the two teams playing a similar tactic, or the two managements, was there ever a kind of clash of that? I mean, should you just have had the one man in charge of the two?
Well, we kind of had sometimes. Maybe yeah. Darren McDermott was in charge of both, you know. Yeah. And I suppose that time the National League started in November, you know, you played 4 or 5 matches before Christmas, and it was led up a bit earlier where it gave you a chance then to. We used to go at the football, Brendan, then for a couple of months, you know, and then back to the hurling championship. So, look, we staggered it good. And the thing about it, we had 12 dual players, maybe out of the 15. So we just made it work, you know, and kept the bodies fresh in between both codes. And, look, there was times that the football maybe suffered a bit in them times. Darren and them done their best to make it work, you know.
Oisin was just making fun of me there when he was putting the call through, but he doesn't realise I'm a former Bart hurler myself. Yeah, that's something that's gone on the radar along and distinguished career. Actually, Mickey, it wasn't long or distinguished. Colm Grant actually seen me pucking about in the garden. My sisters would all play camogie with Donegal there, so me and Marty Kellen used to go down. I wasn't much good. I wouldn't have been in your own style, Mickey, but that was an experience. I even played an inch one time in a championship game under 16. That was quite an experience.
I think I remember that, Bren. I would have been on the bench that time. I'd have been a couple of years younger than you, boys, but I think maybe you got split that night, didn't you?
It was you have a good memory. That Marty Killen actually got split. He was the other Newton man, was down, of course. Marty, being a Downey, had strong links to Bert.
And I suppose maybe Bert had their eye in getting you down to the big ball, Bren. They were just tying you into the hurley for you know, but it didn't work out for us.
Of course, Ronan McLaughlin being one of my heroes, of course, was trying to get him down. I just don't think I could have handled Ronan's team talks, you know. That would have been an issue, Mickey.
Oh, well, the two East and one changed him. It might have been hard one. You know, but Ronan, another great star for Bert, you know, through the years, a dual player. And look, we had some great men, Bren, and we're kind of slowed up a wee bit in the hurling, so we need to get things going again down there at underage level and start building again, you know, and try to get a good bunch of youths coming through again.
Yeah, and tell me, Mickey, was it always in your mind to be a manager, be a coach? Was that in your mind to do that job?
I suppose, Bren, I took a year away, maybe the last couple of years playing with Bert, you were involved in the management, you know, with the senior team and helping out, and maybe 1 year me and Kieran Dodge took the management, you know. So, look, I liked it a bit, and you just want to see the hurling doing well, you know. And then when the job went vacant that last time, I suppose a lot of the players that I played with, Bren, was texting me to go for it and stuff, and I didn't, you know. I left it for a year or two, and then it went vacant again, and they came at me again, you know, and I just got chatting to Catherine, and I said maybe now's the time to give it a go, and glad we did, you know. I inherited a good team, like, and we had a good start with the Nicky Rickard and staying in that Division 2, you know.
That's it, Mickey, and you've gained promotion already. You got that sorted, Mickey, for the shutdown, which is very positive for you going into next year's league and this year's championship.
Yeah, thank God, Bren, because I suppose another week or a few days later, I think every team that was in the top spot would have gone up, and we'd have lost out because our man maybe had us in score difference, you know. So if this virus and all lingers on for a few months, I think they would have probably got the nod ahead of us with that score difference. So very, very fortunate to get that game played and get us back in Division 2 and try and maintain that standard now, Bren. It's not easy. Like, hurling's more tiered than football, you know.
It's a big jump. It's a big jump, isn't it, Mickey? It's like when you're mixing it here and you're winning games, tight games by a point or two, you're going into another world then once you go up that division.
Yes, that's right. I suppose you go up in football, Bren, you can set up defensively and get men behind the ball, and not just as tactical, you know. And if you sit too deep, the ball's knocked over the bar from 70 to yards. So it's really, you really just have to get the boys' speed up, you know, and try to hurl at that standard, and it's not easy, you know. But we've done well last 2 years ago stayed in that division, and no, a massive result was down coming to Letterkenny, brand new team that's won an Ulster titles maybe over the last 10 years and stuff, and for us to turn them over coming to Letterkenny on top of the league, you know, was probably a highlight of managing that to beat a team of down stature, you know.
Yeah, you look, you've really made Letterkenny your home ground. The Foplers just can't seem to win there. It's a funny one, Mickey. Just before we let you go there and get back to the grind, the changing landscape of hurling now, how the clubs that you picked from and the work that's been done, you have a good array of clubs there now feeding into your county team.
Yeah, so probably five or six, Ben. You've Bunkrana and St Unions are putting well there now. McCool's, Satanta and Burke, you know, and there's one or two from Cairn at the minute. Look, we've a good spread, Bren, but I suppose if you're to raise the standard up to keep at that level and stuff, you need to get even the double amount of clubs, you know, you need 15 or 16 clubs in the county to make it work and to stay at a good standard, you know, and get one or two players from each club. But at the minute, it's on the way up, Bren, as terms of selection from clubs. We have five or six there to pick from where maybe Burton, Satanta and McCool's were putting the four there for a long time. So you've got Unions and Bunkrana and Cairn Donagh getting on the fray now in Ballyshannon. So look, it's all positive, Bren. If we get another few clubs, done loads on the way up, if we can get up in the double figure clubs, it can all help, you know.
Well, listen, Mickey, great to hear things are up and up, and as long as men like you keep doing their bit and keep guiding us in the right way, I'm sure that'll continue. Mickey, thanks a million for joining us on the Day of Debate.
Chat to you later. Okay.
Bye, Mickey.
The Dry Arch Complex 24-hour service station, Letterkenny. We're here for all your needs.
Right, everyone, now I'm joined on the line for part two of an in-depth look at the fascinating career of Rory Cavanagh, one which we all know well. We all played a part in supporting him from, you know, the days of Donegal of the Nearly team to the All-Ireland champions. Rory, welcome back to the DL Debate.
Thanks very much, Brendan. Good Rory, to be back on with you again.
Great to have you. Great to have you for all the champagne moments. Rory, we got the bad memories out of the way and we've moved on to the, well, listen, you know, some tough times ahead in terms of training and that. But Rory, just taking you first into your ordinary life, your family life. You married your childhood sweetheart, Catherine. And was there a baby there by this stage or was one on the way?
No, so 2011, myself and Catherine got married December. December the 17th. So, yeah, it was, I suppose, on the back of a good year with the county. We were Ulster champions. It was nice way maybe to end off the year, I suppose, and we headed off on honeymoon then to South Africa for a few weeks, and it was nice. Now,
same place I went. So you were just thinking about the baby at that stage. You've been blessed with three
in total. three in total.
You're a busy man at the minute, all in all. You're coaching as well.
That's right, yeah, so involved with the Donegal under 15s this year. And yeah, listen, I suppose I got into it a couple of years back with the Bunkrana Cup team, the under 16 level, and enjoyed it, like enjoyed that, the whole aspect of it, you know, out in the field and coaching, Brendan. So it was good to get back involved again with the 15s this year, but obviously with this lockdown sort of at present now, the whole season's up in the air, and we don't know will it ever be finished out. So it's a tough situation for everybody, between coaches and players and obviously everybody and families and that. So we don't know where the end line's going to be just yet. We're just going to have to wait and see how it develops.
Hi, Roy. Yeah, just jumping you back to the very start with Jim. You know, from me and your perspective, playing with Unions, you know, we had 2009. We had got around this blanket defence that we'd been caught with in 2005. We knew how to outplay it. But I think that's a club team. I think a county team, 15-foot county players, there's no weak gaps. There's nobody maybe you would get an age on that you might in club. So Jim was coming in, obviously, successful with under-21s, but there must have been a lot of question marks in your mind. You know, you met him at the Clanree for a 1-1, and your early thoughts on it?
I suppose the early thoughts were we had lots of doubts, Brendan, running through our mind. Like, we were coming off the back of a few heavy defeats in previous years, and a lot of this more senior players were at a low ebb, you know, and contemplating whether they play for Donegal again or not. But I suppose the more, you know, Jim talked about what he wanted from us and the way he was going to set up the team, and Obviously, with the 21 teams that he had that previous year, who came within a kick of the ball, won an All-Ireland final. You know, there was a whole wrath of new young talent coming into the team. You know, and 7 or 8 of them came straight into the senior setup, Brendan. But going back to your point about, yeah, listen, his template definitely was to go with a defensive style of football. You know, he did kind of set out in no uncertain terms that, you know, we're going to be playing a counter-attacking brand of football, maybe one that he had developed with Glenties. So, you know, you're right in what you said. We had found out a way around it at the club level, but, you know, at senior level, you know, it came down to a lot of work going on at the S&C side of things. That became a huge priority. You know, the gym sessions were going to have to be adhered to. You know, the fitness levels, we went into new terrain altogether. You know, we spent quite literally went into new terrain. We spent quite a bit of time down in Dunfanaghy going over dunes and things like this here. So, you know, the fitness and the strength and conditioning became a big, big priority under Jim, and we were just, you know, finding a new level altogether in terms of how we prepared for a season. Like, we were into new territory altogether, so it was tough to take maybe initially, because you had all these doubts going through your head, and, you know, are we good enough? Are we going to be able to compete when push came to shove? Because ultimately, you know, down through the years, that's when we fell flat on our faces, was when, you know, in the big games against the Armaghs and the big games against the Tyrones, and, you know, he had very much his sight set on Tyrone once the championship draw was made, and knowing that we would more than likely, if we were doing our job, meet them at a quarter or semi-final stage, you know.
Mm. And, right, you know, I used to be, you obviously got on very well playing with that. I used to slag you about being a bit thin. I used to call you String Bean at the time. Now, you were told to put on 1.5 stone. I soon stopped calling you that, though. You probably would have put me away with a box. But even your body shape, Roy, changed dramatically. You know, there's no doubting you were eating totally different. You were basically almost a professional athlete. I mean, you still had to do your day job, but outside of how you were treating it, was so professional.
Well, that was it. You know, we just encountered new ways and new levels of preparing, you know, and as I said, like, the S&C became a huge priority for me, Jim. You know, I was 12 and a half stone at the time, and, you know, he'd wanted me, you know, from one of those first discussions to move from a wing forward position into midfield, which meant, you know, packing on a stone and a half to get up to 14 and a half stone. So, you know, it was a shock to the system. You were meeting with sort of nutritionists, and you know, they were advising 3,500 calories to be consumed on a daily basis. So, like, yeah, this all was all new to us, and I was kind of thinking, God, I'm going to be busy here, you know. So you were, you know, preparing food for your breakfast and lunch and dinner for the following day, and, you know, there was a lot of dedication and maybe, you know, to prepare yourself for your weekly schedule with your S&C, and then obviously we had our S&C sessions in the morning, and you were going on to your work after that, and then, you know, the collective sort of sessions during the week, and obviously then at the weekends we were meeting twice a week on Saturdays Saturdays and Sundays down in Dunfanaghy. So we just moved into new territory altogether when it came to S&C and when it came to training, and it opened up a lot of our eyes, especially the more senior fellas. I'd say the 21s were kind of well used to Jim's regime, haven't worked with him for the previous 12 months. But for a lot of us older fellas who were kind of experienced, you know, a lot of us were in around the 28 years of age mark, so it certainly opened up our eyes on what could be achieved in terms of our preparation for games.
Yeah, right. And you know, I think as word filtered out about the absolute dedication that you were at and the life changing stuff you were doing, I think that really, you know, fed into the, you know, the amount of respect and support you got from fans and from people supporting the team. Because it wasn't as if you just decided, we'll give it a bit more commitment, we'll change things a bit, and you got across the line. There was such a change to your life, and I think that fed through to everybody. Right? And just, you started up, Murphy was made captain straight away, right? 2011.
Yeah, he came in. He was obviously captain the 21 team, and came straight in. And
Jim, know, like that's a massive move. But there's no doubt. Listen, it was the right move. And I know some of you, when I heard about it first, I must admit, with the likes of yourself there, likes of Big Neil, Cass, fellas like that, he thought, "What, was that a bit soon?" But there's no doubt, and Jim knew what he was doing. And of course, it was the right thing to do. Michael can handle anything, as we've seen going on from there. Rory, the start to the whole thing was a bit of a, you know, you were, I remember 8 points down to Sligo in the first league game. I remember actually thinking, you know, where's your
it? It was one of those freak games. Yeah. It was one of those freak games in Ballybuffet where you're thinking, you know, is this your system, you know, this style of play, is this, you know, ever going to pay off, you know? But I think we managed to salvage a draw out of the game, you know, later on. You know, really from there then we started to find our feet a wee bit in terms of how he wanted us to play, because, you know, it was such a shift to, for a lot of us, like, you know, me and you were involved with the Union team that would have, you know, tried to press a wee bit higher up the field and, you know, rather than maybe turn as I was doing anyway as a midfielder and getting back and covering maybe a full back or a half back, you know. So it took a lot of work on the training field, and it took a lot of sort of explanation from Jim and the management team, you know, of what exactly he wanted in terms of how he wanted us to defend, and, you know, and then obviously if we got a turnover, how we were to spring into attack. But, you know, it did eventually come, but it took a lot of work during that league in 2011.
Yeah, and you eventually obviously won the league, beating Laois in the final in Croke Park, and as you said, Rory, Tyrone were in the sights. It was going to be Antrim up first, and then, Cavan. Was it Cavan or Antrim first? Antrim first in 2011.
It was Antrim first. Yeah.
That's right. The famous Ryan Badley man of the match scenario.
That's right. We got a bit of stick. He got a bit of stick. It was actually something that Jim, I suppose, latched onto, Brendan. You know. I can't remember, was Spillane or somebody had said on the Sunday game that basically nobody deserved the man of the match for that game, because it was, you know, it was just such a dire spectacle. And, you know, Jim latched on to that, and to be fair to him, what he did do and what did come out of that was this whole siege mentality. Yeah. You know, and he managed to create that within the squad very, very early on, and it was almost us against the rest of Ireland, you know, when it, you know, because we were coming under a lot of, you know, criticism obviously for our style of play. So we fed off that, you know, and Jim was very obviously good at portraying that in the media and creating that siege mentality. So, you know, we weren't lacking for any motivation then when it came to training on Tuesday and Thursday nights, you know.
And yeah, Roy, I didn't mind leave Cavan out. Yourself and Raff for midfield. You got a goal that day against Cavan, kind of blew them away. It took you on the, crazy as it might seem, Roy, after all the Ulster finals and that, it was the first semi-final in 5 years against Tyrone, and all eyes was on them. And I think, Roy, this was maybe the biggest turning point in the whole Jim era, was this game.
It was, because that was the game that we had been building towards all year, really. You know, that they were the benchmark, that, you know, something that we had to get beyond if we were going to be build a success, you know, in our own heads and for our supporters. Like, so, you know, that game was building for maybe 6 or 7 months, Bryn, and, you know, early on, it wasn't going too good. You know, I think there was a lot of nervousness initially in that game. Like, you know, we weren't great. You know, I think Tyrone were well on top of us from what I can remember in the first half. And you would have to say we were kind of in the second half, obviously, with the goal. I think McFadden got a goal to push us into a lead. But, you know, we almost just kind of out Tyrone on that day, in terms of digging in and really showing a new mental toughness, if you like, which hadn't been associated with Donegal teams down in the past.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, right, the thing about, they created 18 scoring chances in the first half and at 6 points, and we created 6 scoring chances and 4 points. We only were done 2 down, and it was a half where they could have had a goal as well. The reason I say, Roy, not only was it a turning point in terms of us and Tyrone and that, but to get into an Ulster final, which we would against Derry, was huge. I mean, we were going to take Derry. But I think the time frame of everything with Geminis tactics had a certain time frame, Roy. And particularly if you fast forward to 2014, how teams in 2013 even started to get defensive. You know, no Baker in the first day did do it. But by and large, a lot of managers were still playing their own game. So I think the Ulster final was going to be huge. But then the mindset that was going to give us going on from there, and, you know, obviously beating Throne, massive game, yeah, Brick's goal tied it up, it was put it to 169, and of course, no, sorry, McFadden's goal tied it up, and then Brick, you know, I think you were shouting at him, put it over the bar, as we all were, and he stuck it in the back.
Put it over the bar, right.
So, you know, right, listen, massive win, got into Ulster final then against Derry. Was there a bit of a sense of, you know, that was the first Ulster final in 13 years that didn't feature our man Tyrone, which is a crazy statistic. But going into that game, there must have been a sense of, you know, surely this is one we're going to take home.
It was building, and that was just such a huge, maybe psychological step as well, you know, that we had beaten one of the traditional powers, like Tyrone. We're heading for a 3 in a row at that stage, like, so, you know, to get that victory over them was massive for our self-confidence, and we certainly felt like, you know, whoever we know, we were meeting Derry in the final, that, you know, we would be a good match for them, you know, given the fact that there was no Armagh there as well. So, like, you know, it definitely set us up well going into that game, and ultimately we were just delighted to get over the line. You know, we can't even remember much about that game. I know you had an injury sort of going into that game, an ankle injury, Brendan, but, you know, just to get there finally after 19 years and seeing that sort of outpouring of emotion among the supporters and, you know, teammates and management and everybody, it was fantastic to finally achieve that, like, especially given the hard work that went in, like, in it earlier on in the season.
Yeah, and really, just there's a couple of real epic games that stand out. Of course, the next one up, you know, Kildare at headquarters, really, just, I mean, it started off actually very low scoring. You know, McGeaney, in fairness to him, you look where Kildare have got now, he had them up pretty close, you know, in terms of the best he could do with that squad and that side. And what a game was that. It had everything in it, you know, and some blistering performances. Obviously one of the best individual performances I've ever seen from Carey Lacy, from any player. You know, Christy Toy's substitute appearance. And it's the only time ever, Roy, I've been doing commentary where the guy in the studio goes, one at a time, please, because me and me, the commentator, were shouting and roaring at each other at the same time. Such was the emotion, Roy. It, your memories of that night, it was a magical night.
It was, like, you know, you couldn't have really scripted it, you know, the fact that going to extra time and so many twists and turns in it. But you're right, like, I do remember, like, Lacey's performance for me when you're up at close quarters and you're witnessing that sort of speed in the tackle that he's able to do, you know, the speed of hands and the footwork, you know, and then transitioning up the field and up and down, and just to see that work rate sort of up close and personal was phenomenal from him. But, you know, there was many brilliant performances from so many players. You know, you think back to even the dying moments, like, you know, the one toy put in the back of the net after being out for so long. Like, it was brilliant for him to be coming back into a game like that there and doing what Christy does, the coolest man in the whole stadium, you
That's
know,
him.
And in those sort of one-on-one situations to put on the back of the net to bring us back into the game. And, you know, obviously, the point from Cass was just phenomenal. Like, you know, I still don't know how he had the energy in his legs to kick a point from almost 50 yards. Like, it was phenomenal. Just way to finish out a game. Because, like, there were men going down right, left and centre with cramp, and it was just the nature of the game. Everybody had left every last sinew of their being out in the pitch. So, no, it was brilliant, you know, and more importantly, it set us up then, you know, to go on again to new territory again, to go from a sort of quarter final into, you know, a semi final, which was again new territory for us, you know, and one that gave us great confidence, you know, going into.
Yeah, right, because we were 5 points down in that game, you're right. Christy Toy coming on, I mean, Cass is just out of this world point, you know, it seemed to have everything. It was such a brilliant night, and it was great to be there. Rory, you're in now to a semi final, and Dublin, of course, they had their own pressures on not having won the, you know, 16 years since they were in a final. And, you know, you were earmarked to look after Michael Dara. At one stage, he called you a tramp and all. which is a good sign, Rory, because you must have been getting on.
Pleasantries going back and forth.
Must have been getting under his skin, Rory. But get in that semi-final, Rory, was the mindset, you know, that this system can't be beat? Did you think at that time getting into the game that you very much could tie up Dublin and potentially go all the way?
Well, that was definitely the mindset with everybody in the group. You know, we felt that we had enough to take them down, but, you know, that game obviously will go down in infamy with the scoreline, and it was bizarre because you're right, Dublin had changed their approach under Gilroy and Mickey Whelan. Like, Dublin had shipped a very, very heavy defeat previously, and Gilroy was determined not to see the same sort of defensive performance repeat itself as it did against, was it Kerry maybe the year before? They were annihilated maybe, yeah. Or maybe that was 2 years previous. But anyway, they had changed their template, and you had a bizarre scenario, Brendan, of, you know, their half back line / midfield would refuse to go up the field. Granted, they had only probably one defender or one attacker to mark and Colin McFadden, but, like, they wouldn't come out, and obviously we wouldn't come out, and it had just this stalemate, you know, and the boos were ringing out. That's from right. Quite early days, and, you know, but you go back to it, like, we were quite happy, you know, with where we were at half time. In fact, even going a point ahead, and Colum, it might have been Colum in the second half, earlier on in the second half, had a chance. One of his efforts flew over the bar. If that had been a few inches lower and it was a goal, you know, we would have been in a very commanding position. But look, I think ultimately what came out of that game, Brendan, was, you know, we needed to develop an offensive sort of strategy, you know, that okay, we had done brilliantly to win sort of Ulster for the first time in 19 years, but, you know, at Croke Park, where there's a bigger pitch and more space, if ultimately we wanted to challenge for the All-Ireland, that we needed to do something and tweak, you know, our style of play so that we were more of a threat on the opposition half of the field. And that was the big thing to come out of that Dublin game, that there was a consensus there between management and players that, listen, we have to find ways of being much more of a threat and more potent in our inside forward line.
Yeah, it was a perfect setup, I suppose, really, because you had got that defensive side of your game right, and you had tasted Ulster Championship, you had tasted the game in Croke Park, so you could then go back, see what you didn't do well or what you needed to change, which was when runners were coming out with the ball, there wasn't enough people coming with them. McFadden was isolated on his own. So what you had was the template for it, but you knew how to work it. And no one, like, years gone by, Rory, you know, lip service would have been paid to say something, a tactic or something like that, whereas, you know, But under 2012, the rights were going to be wrong. Such was in-depth luck, as Jim. I mean, I was laughing at the book room when you were on about the amount of team huddles. You know, training sessions going on for 2 hours, 2.5 hours, crazy stuff. And Ryan Bradley rolling his eyes. I mean, some players would have been more impressed.
Bradley wasn't impressed when he got cold.
I can imagine, because you're training so hard, and there's this big talk, and Roy, and you know, everybody was good at it.
The two of them would be bouncing ideas off one another.
And you know. Roy, just before we get into 2012, obviously, you know, you two things, I suppose. You started a book, you started with Conall Dunn. Come to a training session in 2011, you know, with an injury and thinking he shouldn't have to train, and McGuinness not being impressed, and that was it gone, you know. And we both know that Conall would have worked perfect in those systems and would have done well. And I'd often think if he was from Glenthie's area, would he have been kept in some way? I would say more than likely he would, you know. And I always felt bad that a player like that, because he would have been wholehearted. Conall was one of those guys who would have done anything for you, and I think would have fitted well, and that system would have done different jobs for us, whatever that might have been, Roy. Obviously then, Andy, this year, Cass in, the book come out, there's a big furore about that there. Probably, you know, the whole thing, Roy, was not something that anybody was expecting. I don't think Cass done it out of any, like, malice. I think Cass was always very open and just does his own thing. But that contradicted the way the squad was set up in terms of the bond that the group had, as far as you were concerned.
Aye, well, you know, obviously that was a big moment and big shock for everybody, and it, you know, you're looking at it maybe had the capacity maybe to create sort of a chasm then between supporters and the team or and the management, you know, and always kind of felt, well, how's his clubmates, how's the two McGees going to react to all this news? So it definitely, it was massive news. I think obviously Jim's, the way he looked at it, he felt that, you know, Kevin probably should have you know, pointed out that to the squad and to the management if he was doing a book. But I agree what you're saying. Like, I don't think he meant it in any sort of malice or to purposefully do the team harm or far from it, you know, because he had been brilliant for us right the way through 2011, you know. So to see sort of him go, like, there was a major sort of refocusing then of everybody's mind, you know, that this now has got real serious for everybody, you know. You know, and it was a tough one for Cass. You know, I remember calling him, you know, to see if there was any sort of middle ground, Brendan, but that could be reached between the two of them. But you know, Kevin, you know, being the man he was, he said, listen, I'm going to sort it with Jim myself. But unfortunately, the two of them couldn't agree, and they went their separate ways. But, you know, it did serve to highlight, you know, Jim and the team, let's say, you know, if there was something set out that was agreed upon by the squad, then that was the parameters in which everybody had to operate within. And it really heightened the sense of purpose from everybody then going forward into the 2012 campaign, Bren.
Yeah, and listen, just such a pity it happened, because, I mean, what a warhorse he was for Donegal. It's something that always sits in me, Roy, as we look back at that situation. We just wish it had happened, that he had been there to pick up that medal All-Ireland Day. But, Roy, just going into 2012 now, McGuinness' mantra in 2011 was, can I trust you? It was now switched to hope you miss, which was going to be don't have a scenario where you're just hoping that the forward misses. You got to be in the right place at the right time, and this was being, and in many ways, where the training seems a bit like the Navy SEALs, you know. It seems a real, not just a physical training, but there's a real mental aspect of, you know, do repetitive, just so you kind of click in the exact gear on the pitch. You know, was there ever a time you were hearing it in your dreams, or was it tough going?
Listen, like, they would drive training, you know, between Jim and Rory to a degree that we had never experienced before. And that was in the horrible sort of winter nights in Castle Finn, or whether it was on the dunes of Dunfanaghy or wherever it may have been. Like, when you started training, like, you were left no uncertain terms of a level that you needed to get to. And, you know, we soon understood what his level was. And then everybody within the group became aware of what the level was. And I remember, you know, it could be the easiest of drills, you know, in terms of two groups facing one another, and it can be a hand pass drill. But if it was not at 100% and a level, he would persist with it and keep going until we got to a certain level. So it didn't matter if you were coming off a game at the weekend, or if the body was tired, or whatever excuses you may have wanted to make in your own head. You know, the expectation was there, and it was constant, and it was driven ferociously by Jim. And to be fair to him, like, he got us to a level that we didn't know existed.
Yeah, and you're nothing off league. You're back in the top flight. Were you losing a couple of early games, like to Leash and Down? You noticed that McCartan was shouting, "Keep it wide, keep it wide." You had the feeling where, obviously, managers were looking how you were playing, and that you got a wallop in against Kerry. But you decided you turned a corner then, where you weren't scoring enough, and you was obviously, you know, people forget about that and that league, how poorly those early stages went in 2012. But you just turned the corner, and a great victory against Armagh the last day propelled you into the championship. And Rory, after that league, what was the feeling that, listen, this is just a league, we stayed in Division One, we're happy enough, we're ready for Ireland tilt, or did that league throw some questions up in your mind as you went into the championship?
Now, you're right to point out that we weren't, you know, flying in the league. You know, we'd been promoted from Division 2 the year previously, and obviously we're up against better teams then in Division 1. But it did come down to that game against Armagh. It was kind of, we needed to win that. It was us or them, and I think, yeah, we won it, and Armagh were relegated in Ballybofey. So, you know, I go back to the Kildare game as well, in O'Donnell Park. We conceded a late goal, and I always remember it for, you know, what came out of it, which was a real, you know, forensic analysis of how we could concede a goal in the dying embers of a game for Kildare to, I'm not sure was it snatch a draw or a win, but anyway, it seemed to be a big moment for us, because, you know, obviously our analysis sessions and all would have went on for a good couple of hours as well, whenever we did meet to look at a game. So, you know, I think, you know, what came out of that was, you know, we needed to be a lot meaner, you know, when it came to our game management, Brendan, and to see games out, as well as, obviously, as you say, you know, trying to find ways of being a more potent force in the attack. But I think the Armagh game and, you know, Ballybofey, we came out on top of that, gave us just that wee bit of momentum then to go into the championship. The fact that we had consolidated our place in Division 1, and it took us in well to the Cavan game and Breffni in the preliminary round, you know.
Yeah, a huge thing, right, because even as the league, it's the top flight, and you know in a tight game, if you come through, it's going to give you confidence. You go into 2012, also championship again, where you're having to go the long way around. You beat Cavan, you beat Derry, our neighbours Tyrone once again. They just didn't seem to wanted to mix it with us these times, Rory. We just had the tactics that were working against them, Rory. And of course, Down, and again, back-to-back Ulster finals. And the scoring was certainly put right, 2-18 against Down, Rory. And that lift of going through Ulster again, did that then change your mind to say, right, we can do that this year, you know, back-to-back Ulsters, Rory, after such a long wait? It must have been real dream stuff.
Yeah, like, you know, we'd obviously disposed of Cavan fairly well in that preliminary game, you know. And I remember picking up an injury myself before the Derry game, and watching on as the boys, like, I think it was fantastic performance, like looking on it. And I was actually really worried then from a selfish point of view. I was thinking, I'm not going to get back into this team here. You know, Big Neil had a great game. I think it was Ryan Bradley was in midfield alongside him, like, and both of them were fantastic. So I remember being really worried then, sort of coming into the Tyrone game thinking, Christ, I might get back into the starting team here. I had a bit of bother with my ankle, but you know, luckily, you know, I came in just at the right time and got enough training under my belt to start in the Tyrone game, and it went fairly well for me. So I was back in the team, but you definitely sensed that, you know, there was huge momentum with us. I think teams were still figuring out how to counteract, you know, our system, in terms of teams just seemed to be kicking the ball away against us a lot, or running into tacklers, and we seemed to be coming out on the right side of those wee victories and rampaging up the field and counter-attacking well and punishing them at the other end. So there was this whole sense of, there was this sense of inevitability, and almost when, as we were making our way through these games, that teams had yet to figure out our style of play. And, you know, it culminated then in a fantastic performance, you know, putting up a really, really big score in the Ulster final against Down. And you know, Frank McGlynn's performance was fantastic that day, you know, and as was a whole host of others. So, like, you know, there was serious momentum this time going into the quarterfinals, whereas the year before you could argue that, you know, we were in new terrain, but now we had experienced the big day in Croke Park, and we were determined, you know, to go another couple of steps and more.
Of course, against Aristocrats and Kerry, and Rory, I totally agree with you. I don't think Kerry were in any way prepared for our system, and I think that was a big thing for Donegal in 2012, in terms of a lot of teams. Kerry still playing their brand of football. I mean, they hit 19 wides against us on the day, we hit 6, and it just shows you that was the pressure we were putting them on, and then they were shooting from awkward angles, and as you say, playing into your minds, but it was playing into your hands in many ways, but it was still Kerry. We were on 11 to 8 points up 65 minutes in, you thought game over, but then there was a late Kerry onslaught which almost caught us at the end. They even had the chance to equalise, really. So, you know, teams like that, they're never beat, and I suppose it was a big lesson for us in there, in terms of learning that we can have a team in their box, but until the game's over, it's never over.
No, like, ultimately it came down to one kick out at the end of the game. You know, it was approaching 70 minutes and we were a point up, and it came down to this sort of kick out, and luckily we got a breaking ball, and we fed it to Carl Lacey, and Carl went up to give us the insurance point. But you're right in what you're saying. Kerry were not prepared for, you know, our system. They kicked the ball away an awful lot. They were getting involved in sort of un-Kerry-like things, like pot shots from out and around 45 and outside the scoring zone. And, you know, I don't think we were terribly good that day. If you ask anybody, we were actually rode our luck a lot of phases during that game, particularly in the first half. We got quite a fluky goal from Colum, from a sideline ball in, a long sideline ball. Murphy made a nuisance of himself and it went, ended up in the back of the net. But we weren't good. You know, Brendan, if you were to analyse the game, we were not good ourselves. You know, I think we wasted a lot of possession ourselves. But what we did bring was a level of physicality, a level of sort of organisation, and work rate that, you know, Kerry weren't able to match on the day, and luckily we could see the game out in the second half, but it was fine margins, Bryn, you know.
Yeah, well, I suppose we're in many ways, I mean, let's be honest, we were ranked 19 at the start of the previous year. I mean, it wasn't if we could become a perfect machine straight away, but I suppose the main thing is that you didn't, you know, get away from your game plan, that you played to your strengths. And that's what we were doing at the time. So we dispatched Kerry up next park. Obviously, the history of them hammering us in 2009, posting the biggest score ever on a, I think it was a quarter at that stage, Rory. And we had them now in the semi-final. And I think They had had 2.19 against Kildare in the previous game in their quarter final. I think that was a good thing for us in many ways, because we all know how Cork play. They were going to come, they were physical, they were going to score a lot. So whenever that met our blanket defence, you knew, Rory, that you could break them down, and this was going to work against them. Again, still a titanic match in many ways. There wasn't a lot in it. Donegal just having that wee bit more composure, and I think that's when you go back to your belief in the system, and a team that doesn't have an out-and-out system, it always, you know, the advantage goes back to Donegal there when the game gets tight.
You know, you talk about the constants in the game, you know, and I suppose the constants under the Jim McGuinness era were, you know, that ferocious tackling that he demanded every night at training, and you know, that work rate and that collective, you know, responsibility when it came to your defensive duties. Those constants brought us through a lot of games, even though we weren't playing at our peak. I think that Cork game, you know, for the purists and any supporters that I would have talked to afterwards, and since like would have said that was probably the best game of football that under Jim's management, you know, it was sort of end to end in the first half, you know, scored one end, Cork would reply, and it had that sort of ping pong nature to it for the entire first half. But the trait that we were developing most in these games when we were analysing our own performances afterwards would have been this sort of third quarter surge that became sort of a hallmark of that Donegal team. And it was great to see, you know, us being able to pull away from a team like Cork who had, you know, who had won their All-Ireland in 2010 and had a lot of season campaigners and were, you know, by right a big physical imposing team, particularly around that middle third. You know, they had big men. And, you know, you had Neil Geller who just gave one of the best sort of displays of fielding that you're ever likely to see or ever will see again, you know, in that game. And, you know, if it wasn't for the fetching ability of Big Neil that day, you know, we could have crumbled up on the rocks. But, you know, thankfully, you know, we had that middle third surge, as said, we pulled away. And again, you know, that afterwards, fantastic scenes again to know that you'd finally made it to sort of an All-Ireland final, you know.
Yeah, Roy, and you know, amazingly, looking back to 2010, you know, you in your heart of hearts, an All-Ireland final, but you were finally there, you'd made it, you know, such a quantum leap in the 2 years. And Roy, it should have been Dublin, everybody was thinking it was going to be Dublin, it was Mayo. Now, you know, me going to games and analysing games and the sound bites coming out from James Horn and that about them going to play their own way and that, I just felt our system, as we kept coming back, it was going to come into a tight match. You know, our system was going to be the difference between the two teams. And you get into the game, right, that wee voice in your head tell you that listen, this is Mayo, they're going to be a bit brittle and you know, our system will take over? Or did you just think, listen, this is another team, we're just going to keep to the system and don't deviate from any thoughts outside of that?
I will, I suppose, to use a phrase coined by Jim, like the team were fully sort of locked on then, you know, coming into that All-Ireland final against Mayo. And I suppose there was a fair degree of needle between us down through the years, and you know, I remember playing a challenge game down in Markovic Park in Sligo against them, and it got quite ill-tempered at times. And again, you know, a couple of the league meetings were spicy. There was another game down in Swinford where, you know, Jim was threatening to pull the players as well off the pitch because, you know, the challenges were becoming a wee bit over the top and bordering on sort of reckless and dangerous. So there was that element of that game as well, you know. And if you were to ask any of those sort of Mayo players themselves, Bren, like, I would say they were very, very confident the fact that they were meeting us in the final as well. Like, so, like, certainly from our approach, we weren't really we weren't letting complacency get in the door at all. Like, we were still driving it on really, really well when it came to our trainings and our intensity that we brought in training. So we're still very focused on, you know, just getting over the line, you know, because obviously it was the biggest game of any of our lives. So, you know, we hadn't won it in such a long time, Mayo a wee bit longer. So one of us was going to be creating sort of history. So, you know, we're just delighted then ultimately that it was us in the end up, you know. But going back to what you said there, you know, about Jim's approach before the final and I'm focusing on that long sort of diagonal into the Mayo full back line, you know, it was something that we did work on quite a bit. You know, before that final was trying to expose maybe a weakness in that full back line, and it was just one of those moves off the training field where Carroll delivered sort of that inch perfect ball into Michael, and of course that goal, that iconic goal, was phenomenal lift for us so early in the game to see that rattle the back of the net, you know, give us such a surge of confidence that course throughout the team, you know, and we went on to get the second and possibly could have got a third as well, you know. Colm had a great one. He probably just miskicked it at the final moment to add a third, like, but we were really on a crest of a wave in those first sort of few minutes, you know. But fair play to Mayo, like they dug it out, they dug in and they, towards the sort of second part of that first half, they came at us rightly, you know, more probably down to our own unforced errors and things like that, when, you know, again, turning over possession easily and being punished at the other end, and brought the Mayo, I think, to within 3 points of us. So it was still very much to play for going into that second half. But ultimately we just managed to keep them at sort of arm's length for the duration of the game. But, you know, the sort of memories of the second half were just that, and that we were doing just enough, to maintain that 3-point, 4-point gap, you know.
Yeah, Murray, listen, that Murphy goal's etched in the mind. McFadden one was a bit lucky. The Mayo guy spilling the ball and he buried it low. And that second goal went in where he said, give us such a platform. And Mayo, as you say, didn't throw in the towel. And why would you All-Ireland final day? They did have a go. You're right, Murray. I felt that we were so in control, we got a bit sloppy in possession, did invite them back into it a bit. But listen, as you said, you were scared to look at the clock in the closing minutes, but finally that whistle went. Rory, joy and elation. Lovely line in the book about your dad and the tears in his eyes and meeting your family, Catherine, after the game. And just the joy that goes with that, Rory. And of course, coming back then to Donegal Town and, you know, just the scenes around there. Jim getting up by Daniel on the stage and, you know, going round all the clubs and that. Like, it just looked like you were running. And like the story of Jim saying we need some food on the bus as you went round, and Frank McGlynn shouted up more beer he was after. But, you know, I thought you might have got up on the stage along with Raff and give it a wee bit of Pat McCready when you got back to Letterkenny. But listen, Rory, such proud moments.
My voice is gone at that stage.
Say, I know, I remember meeting you around that time when you were running on some kind of adrenaline, you know, between that and obviously having a few beers, no sleep, and the voice was going on everybody. You know, it must have been such a tiring time. Without that buzz, you could never have kept it going. But Rory, such proud moments for you coming back here to Letterkenny, to the school, the boys' school, and to St. Eunan's, and everywhere you just went, really, it's such hero stuff. I mean, can anybody have any better memories? And if you're a GA person, you know, between 92 and 2012, there were such magical times.
No, it was, I mean, fantastic, and it's something that'll sort of live long in the memory for all the group that was involved, you know. And those were the special times, you're right, in what you said, like the times when you were coming into your own town or village, whatever the case may be, and sort of coming up, and it was myself and Kevin, obviously, that they got to do it in front of our own supporters there in Letterkenny. That was phenomenal memories for us, you know, and ones that we'll cherish for a long, long time, you know. But it was great, you know. You were running here, there, and everywhere for a month, you know, or two after, and probably didn't set us up ideally going into the following season, but it was one of these situations for Jim, like, you know, how do you stop or put a dampener on that when people had been starved of all Ireland success for such a long, long time? You kind of almost felt obliged to let people in and let people savor it as much as they can, whether that was with photographs or shindigs and pubs or whatever the case may be, you know. People had to savor it because you didn't know when it would happen again, you know.
Oh, they were well deserved. They're well, well deserved, and no one would take that away from you. Right, even you managed to pull it together for me. I thought you'd give me a big mention in the book around my excellent coaching and management to the county title in 2012, but you seemed to kind of bypassed that a small bit.
Were you a manager there? Were you a player coach?
I was water boy. We obviously beat Niamh Conlon, so it was some season for you all then. And Roy, we jump into 2013 then. We could nearly bypass it pretty quickly, but a relegation there. We got a ass whooping by Mayo. We did make an Ulster final. We got an ass whooping by Mayo then at Croke Park, Roy. But I think in many ways that we kind of writ that year off, and it was, I suppose, going into 2014, then Rory left the scene, which was probably a big blow for you. But I think after 2013, and not that it was a year off, Rory, but you hadn't hit the highs. Was it somewhat of a recharge the batteries, come back in for 2014? I know Rory left, which Jim got a new backroom team, which again new life into the situation. Paul McGonigal and Dover and John Duffy and that came in, wasn't it? And was there a case of, right, let's pick this up and go for it again, or what was the feeling in the camp?
I think a big motivating factor was, you know, I suppose we had stumbled our way into an Ulster final again. In 2013, you know, the season didn't get off to a good start. We've both been relegated, obviously. But we managed to regroup somewhat and find ourselves in the Ulster final. But, you know, to be fair to Monaghan, they were a real tough, tough team and a very, very hungry team on the day, you know, and sort of thoroughly deserving winners. We had just maybe no answer for the level at which they brought to that day. You know, they were just ferocious for the 70 minutes and, you know, thoroughly deserved a win. But we probably weren't at a level that obviously we had been to the previous year, and injuries started to take their toll and different things. But, you know, Tighe na hEan away from Monaghan, they were the best team in Ulster that year, without a doubt. And as you say, we came a cropper against Mayo, you know, who were probably still hurting from the year previous, and they fairly handed us a defeat and a half in Croke Park that day. But so it was a lot of, you know, obviously with the use of Rory and some of the other management team, you know, being not there anymore, and new blood added. Again, it was another refocusing of the minds and saying, right, the slate is clean here again for absolutely everybody. What are our targets? What are our sort of expectations for the year? And, you know, there was a lot of honest talks, I suppose, between the boys, at that time. And, you know, is there another big push in us? You know, and those ultimately were the sort of questions that the group were asking of themselves. And, you know, were we going to go to those levels again, and into that new terrain again, and push beyond that threshold that we knew that what was needed to get to back to where we wanted, which was, you know, obviously winning an Ulster and trying to progress to an All-Ireland final. So, It definitely, you know, with the restructuring of the management team, it did bring a bit of a fresh approach, and the challenge and the gauntlet, if you like, was laid down to the players then again. Like, have you got it in the pit of your stomach to go into that uncomfortable terrain, and in terms of your training, in terms of your S&C, and trying to get back on top?
Yeah, and this one was a huge ask again. You knew it was ahead of you, and everybody did buy in there. And you had a few injury problems as well, Rory, which you had to contend with. at the time between originally your ankles and then your back, was that your hamstring, you know? So it was a matter of, like, Rory, that tight day training, there's no room for any kind of niggle, and you're going to the very limit of it, so you need to be right. And of course we had great people in the background, the likes of JD, you know, Donald Reid, Sean Riley, not just great physios, mm-hmm. but great guys. I mean, some of the stuff JD used to do over the years, driving from Drogheda and driving around the whole county, treating everybody and driving home again, you know, mm-hmm. absolutely crazy stuff. Some of the stuff, Roy, in the background that people wouldn't be aware of, the commitment of people in the background to get everybody to the level they needed to be on the pitch.
That was phenomenal, like, and you mentioned the boys there, you know. And that's probably one aspect that, you know, maybe supporters and that aren't fully aware of is the dedication, you know, that is needed in terms of a backroom team as well, you know, and, you know, masseuses and physios and everybody doing their work to get you onto the field, because we were an aging panel. Maybe there was a cohort there of us that were the wrong side of 30 at that time then, and you know, it definitely required those fellas, you know, putting in the work on your body to make sure that you were able to train on a Tuesday or Thursday or get ready for a match. And it's something that, you know, that can be easily overlooked, but to be fair to Jim, he made sure that those personnel that you mentioned were there and were driving up for long distances, you know, from JD, as you said, from Dublin there to be there on a Saturday morning, so that he was able to have your body in pristine condition for a match the following week. You know, it was a fantastic effort from everybody.
Some commitment, Roy. I'm just conscious of time here. You got your Ulster title back, beat Monaghan. I'm just going to fast forward you a bit, which obviously was a massive lift again for the county, another title, 3 and 4 years against our old foes Monaghan. It was them or Tyrone. Each time we had to put away, and it was Monaghan this time, Roy. So we go into a collision course with Dublin. Everybody's looking at Dublin. We're already talking to Dublin before we had to deal with Armagh. And just when I was speaking to you about tactically, Roy, a lot of teams are getting tactically shrewd. We played Armagh in a quarter final. A lot of people kind of forget about it, and it was a nip and tuck game. It came down to the smallest of margins in the end. We managed to beat Armagh just about, and stage was set for the greatest defensive team in the country against the all-out attacking Dubs, Rory, in what was, you know, as a standalone game, probably the most talked about or remembered game in the 4 year era.
It was, like, you know, because you had this billing of this unstoppable force, you know, as in Dublin, and you know, they were obviously overwhelming favourites, and rightly so, because they were playing fantastic football. They had unbelievable team, you know, six forwards that, you know, were really sort of marquee and could tick scores, win their own ball, and just play a lovely brand of football. Like, so they were the favourites, rightly so. And I suppose the job for Jim before that game, Brendan, was to try and, you know, devise or get across, I suppose, to the players, listen, this is the way we can beat these this team, you know, because, you know, there weren't a lot of chinks in the armory, let's say. So, but I remember, you know, the game plan that he devised, you know, obviously we knew Dublin would push up man to man, and that's the philosophy they had throughout that year. And again, it probably took that defeat for another shift in thinking from Jim Galvin. So, like, obviously the kickouts, the flick-ons, those ones that kind of, you know, led to goals in that game were the big scores in the game. But, you know, you still had the ice coolness of Colin McFadden and these boys to throw wee dummies and go around the keeper and slide foot under the net, and, you know, and Ryan McHugh, these long bursting runs to get up on the end of passes. So, like, it was probably a game and a performance that you would want in a final, not a semi-final.
Yes.
So that was the big one, because you had this, you know, huge outpouring of emotion from the Donegal faithful, obviously, after beating Dublin. And it was, you know, everyone was so full of pride and everything that it was maybe a wee bit then of an anti-climax coming into the final. And it's dangerous for territory to be in, Brendan, as you know. Right. Dangerous territory to be in, you know, when you produce maybe a performance like that against such a hype team as in Dublin were at that time, to go in then to play Kerry of all teams in a final who are the aristocrats themselves, as you said. So it was probably dangerous territory for us to be going in and not coming in as underdogs, you know.
Yeah, very interesting point, Rory, because the outpouring was huge. I mean, obviously it was the Dubs. They were saying they were unbeatable, we were going to get hammered. You know, looking at the game, you know, I was analysing, thinking, if we get around their mindset, if they start to, you know, crash in that Donegal wave, then the game can go against any team. It doesn't matter how good you are. And a bit like Tyrone 2011, we certainly rode our luck in the first half with a couple of goal chances. They could have been maybe in a lead that would have hurt us, but we just hung on. Had 3-14 ourselves. And one of my abiding memories of it was the picture of Frank McGuinness hugging Jim, and the look in his eyes, you know, that real thing of like, wow, this was just like, as an atmosphere goes, Rory, that tops, you know, any time I've watched Donegal or been involved. And you're right, maybe that was too much then in a semi-final, because you're now in a final against Kerry, and a Kerry team which, you know, amazingly had a replay against Mayo, in many ways a shootout. You know, James O'Donoghue was flying. They're coming into that final, and why, Rory, I was on a bit earlier as we talked about the change in tactics and how Donegal had to come with their game plan and hit early, and if you like, won all Ireland early, is because Kerry now had teams that started to get shrewd, and they obviously, O'Mahony and Murphy was a huge thing. They put in double sweepers, and they in some way kind of mirrored us, and then it came down to a very tight game. First goal for Judas, you know, McGrath left in there 1-1, and bit of a height difference in the background for the first Kerry goal. And then, of course, Papa's unlucky goal, a man that rose, unlucky kick out, which, you know, Donny put away. And really, we were chasing the game. You know, we still had McFadden's fisted effort at the end, I suppose, to hit the post. But, Rory, one of those ones, looking back at it now, that we probably didn't play anywhere near our best, and maybe the semi affected us.
I think, you know, we certainly just didn't get anywhere near the levels of the previous game, but you have to again give credit to Kerry, because they had obviously their homework done and, you know, maintained that block of 4 or 5 bodies that would be a constant there in terms of a protection against the counter-attack. They wouldn't have the sort of rampaging and wing-backs that you might associate with them that would fly up the field. They would hold their position, and you know, with the intention of nullifying any sort of counter attack move from ourselves. So it meant that, you know, getting maybe that quality ball inside to the likes of Colum or Michael, you know, became quite difficult. So yeah, again, it wasn't maybe a great spectacle, because you had both sort of teams, you know, tactically very, very obviously aware of each other's threats and how to nullify them. So, listen, it was, again, I don't think we could have any sort of, complaints about the result. You know, Kerry were fractionally better than us, and I only say fractionally, but they did enough to win that game. And, you know, it's obviously a very sore one for us, you know, that we didn't finish off the job, because, you know, yeah, that was probably one of the big regrets, and looking back, is that we didn't finish off that year and that final and the way that we probably had prepared for. That one was tough to take, Brendan.
Interesting you said fractions, because I think therein lies the issue, Rory. Once a team acts like the other team, as you know, and we've seen it then now as the years goes on, it comes down to those small fractions that it becomes a very tight game of who's the best at what they're doing. And I think, as you're saying, we didn't play their best in the day, but certainly I think in 2012 we had the march on everybody. And as I say, what a fascinating time. And just on that game, you know, Donoghue got player of the year, and McGee marked him out of it in the final. That I fell out with the reporter.
That's right.
That really annoyed me, because McGee had marked every top forward in Ireland, The five best, I actually went through the games, the five best forwards, and out of the five games, 2 points from play from the five of them. He never done, and somehow O'Donoghue still got player of the year. That should have been Neil McGee, but anyway, that's an ugly.
McGee, as you know, like during those sort of 3-4 years, he went to another level in terms of full back play. Like, you know, he was just so sort of powerful and explosive, you know, that, you know, he was there ready to punch a ball away as it was arriving into a full forward. Like, so he almost became the real intimidating sort of force behind much of what was good with Donegal at that time, you know.
Yeah, and Rory, you know what a servant he was, no more than yourself, and you're still playing, Rory. Still involved now in coaching as well. And listen, Rory, what a brilliant career you've had, club and county, right across the board. And listen, I appreciate it. We could put this into 3 or 4 stories, Rory, 3 or 4 episodes to get everything in right. But listen, Rory, thanks so much for joining us and telling us your story in the other bit.
Top man, Brennan. Thank you.
See you, pal.
Take care.
Right, folks, that's a wrap. I want to thank Oisin and Kenneth for producing up here in Highland. The guests today, Mickey McCann, Mick Clifford, and of course our champion Rory Kavanagh there. Great in-depth look at his career between the two episodes there. So that's it for now. Join us next week for episode 8. All the best. Stay safe. Okay.